tackling the Zika virus today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. President Obama calls for better testing and vaccines to battle the Zika virus, but it will not be easy.
We know mosquito-borne viruses can be extremely deadly, and yet we are still in a position where we don't have the tools to fight it.
Plus, Somali refugees in St. Cloud, Minnesota, face discrimination and worse.
I think they've responded with tremendous dignity. They're here, like many generations of immigrants from different countries before them, to build a life.
And a Persian rug seller in LA says it's time his imports were made legal here.
The rugs that were made 150 years ago doesn't have anything to do with politics.
Those stories are coming up today on The World. Glad you could be here. The Zika virus has reached the president's desk. Not literally, but President Obama has been briefed on the dangers of Zika, and he's calling for faster research into treatments and vaccines. Here's what we do know. Zika is transmitted by mosquitoes, and it's got a lot of people in Latin America worried right now. Zika causes a fever and other mild symptoms in most cases, but health officials also believe it's linked to a rise in birth defects in Brazil, which is why pregnant women are being advised not to travel to several countries in Central and South America. We'll hear from Brazil in a few minutes. First, though, let me turn to my colleague Tulip Mazumder. She's the BBC's global health correspondent based in London. Tulip covered the Ebola outbreak in West Africa, and I asked her if she sees any parallels with the current Zika outbreak.
Well, this is not like the Ebola outbreak in many ways, mainly because it is not being transmitted from person to person. It's mainly transmitted through the mosquito, the Aedes mosquito, which came from Africa, has now traveled to Latin America. It's also found in Southeast Asia and South Asia. This is not a virus that you pick up through close contact with people. However, it is a very frightening virus for people who are pregnant or who are considering getting pregnant, as you said. And it is similar in the way that we don't have, the world doesn't have the tools to fight it. There's not a lot known about Zika, less in fact than was known about Ebola. There's not a vaccine, there's not a cure. So really everybody's running to play catch up to try and deal with this thing and put a lid on it as soon as possible.
In the early stages of a disease like this, like Zika, what are the initial concerns when trying to figure out how far it could spread?
People are bracing themselves. I mean, the World Health Organization came out earlier this week and they said, you know, all of the Americas, apart from Chile and Canada, can expect cases because we know that this mosquito that transmits the virus are in these places. So everybody's bracing themselves and beyond the Americas, like I said, South Asia, Southeast Asia and Africa as well are all sort of standing by expecting cases. So at the moment, what authorities in the worst affected areas are doing, you know, such as Northeast Brazil, is they're trying to clear the breeding grounds where these mosquitoes thrive. And this is in standing water. People in these areas are being encouraged to wear mosquito repellent. They're fumigating areas. They're using insecticides to try and cut the mosquito population. I mean, there's even work going on in Brazil right now, and this had been happening in advance of this Zika outbreak, of trying to genetically modify mosquitoes so they don't reproduce as much as we've seen.
So what makes Chile and Canada safe zones for Zika, or rather unsafe zones for Zika and safe for the rest of us?
So Zika thrives in tropical climates. So where it's warmer and wetter, that's where we see this particular mosquito thrive. So here in the UK, for example, you know, you're not likely to have a big spread of cases because it's just not warm enough. The mosquito will die quickly. So that's why it is just in these tropical climates where this can really thrive.
You mentioned, Tulip, that the search for a vaccine for Zika might happen in 3 years. I mean, that totally echoes those early months of Ebola. We might find a vaccine, but might not come around in time to save anybody. Are there other little telltale signs in these early stages of Zika that concern you, that kind of are deja vus of Ebola?
I think the biggest deja vu moment really is that I'm saying again, there is no vaccine, there is no cure. And people are being really terribly impacted by it. Okay, it's not the level or the number of deaths, but clearly it has a huge impact For now thousands of babies. There's going to be a whole generation of children affected by this, and we don't yet know how many that's going to be. It's already coming up to 4,000. That is the biggest case of sort of feeling like, okay, we're back to where we were. But I can't really emphasize enough that this is not Ebola. It's such a different type of virus. It's not passed between person to person. But this is a virus that has been around for a long time. We know mosquito-borne viruses can be extremely deadly, malaria, for example. And yet we are still in a position where we don't have the tools to fight it.
Tulip Mazumdar in London there. She's the global health correspondent for our partners at the BBC. Now to Brazil, where hundreds of thousands of people have already been infected by the Zika virus, and where in recent months more than 4,000 babies have been born with a rare defect affecting the size of the head. That prompted calls in several Latin American countries for women to avoid getting pregnant and for pregnant women outside the region to avoid traveling there. One of the hardest hit areas in Brazil is the northeastern state of Bahia. My BBC colleague Julia Carneiro went there to meet one new mother and her baby.
Gabriel is less than 2 months old, and a physiotherapist is moving his little arms, legs and neck to help loosen his joints. His mother, Mila Mendonça, had the Zika virus when she was a month and a half pregnant. And a few months later, the bad news flooded in. Gabriel has microcephaly, a syndrome that affects his joints and muscles and calcifications in parts of the brain.
Quando a gente fez o primeiro exame, não tinha ainda como identificar que havia uma redução cerebral.
When we held the first exams, there was no way to tell he had a smaller brain at that stage in my pregnancy. It was only detected later. The day I found out, it was the worst day of my life. I cried myself to sleep. I was exhausted from crying.
The problems are visible in Gabriel. His cranium is disproportionately shaped. His face looks a little bit too big for his size. His hands are a bit stiff and one of his legs is bent inwards. But Mila says it was a big relief when he was born because they didn't know what to expect. And she cries when she talks about the help she's been getting from other people to move on.
The affection we receive during all this process, it moves me. So many of our friends offer their prayers and sacrifice. They walk to the Bonfim church. Some stop smoking. We felt so full of love. It was fantastic, you know. So now these are happy tears. I'm sad because of everything you have to go through, but happy that we are not alone in this fight. Our friends and families, everyone's with us.
A família tá com a gente, os amigos estão com a gente, então a gente não tá sozinho, sabe, na luta.
Eu gosto desse peito de minha mãe. Eu gosto de mamar.
Gabriel just woke up and Mila is breastfeeding right now. She's sitting in the beautiful little baby bedroom they set up for him, with light blue walls and pictures of animals on the wall. She says the fact that he's nursing is already a victory because it's difficult for many children with microcephaly. So it's small steps like this that are driving her.
My BBC colleague, Julia Carneiro, reporting from Bahia in Brazil. City workers in Rio there spraying insecticide around the city's famous Samba Drome. Carnival starts in a little over a week, and officials want to make sure the crowds who will gather at the parade venue are safe from the Zika virus, or rather from the mosquitoes that spread the virus, as we heard a moment ago. Catherine Osborne is a reporter in Rio, so you watched some of the spraying at the Samba Drome this week. What are they targeting exactly?
They're targeting the Aedes aegypti mosquito, which spreads dengue fever, chikungunya fever, and now Zika virus, as we know.
Yeah, what does it smell like in the Samba Drome? Like insecticide right now?
There was a brief smell while they were spraying it. They say that they're using an insecticide that doesn't have health consequences. It's a low level, so it doesn't affect people as much as it affects mosquitoes. It should smell probably like a lot of sweat by the time Carnival comes around and not too much like pesticide.
That's a huge stadium, though. I mean, I imagine if you're spraying the whole stadium, some of that insecticide then goes into the neighborhoods. How far and wide are officials spraying?
So both in the Samba Stadium, which will hold thousands of people as Samba schools parade down the main aisle during Carnival, and then also in some of the other parts of the city where there's going to be street parades, what's difficult is that the whole city sort of turns into a carnival. And so You have bands that parade down streets and sometimes improvise and take routes that aren't predicted. So almost everywhere is going to have celebrators. They're spraying in the places where the biggest parades are going to be and hoping that that reduces the risk.
Yeah, I mean, tons of people turn out for Carnival, not just Brazilians, but from all over the world. There must be other steps that they're taking to prepare for this. It's totally unpredictable what could happen.
It is, and that's sort of the nature of Carnival. One concern this year is that there's a possibility that's being investigated that Zika virus, instead of only being spread through mosquito bites, could possibly be transmitted sexually. Sexually transmitted diseases are a concern in Rio Carnival every year, and the health department always distributes condoms both at the Sambadrome and at health posts around the city. Again, it's not certain that Zika could be spread that way, but they're making sure to stay vigilant on that front. And additionally, a lot of education about wearing mosquito repellent.
Olha só, a distribuição de preservativo, isso tem em todos os locais do carnaval.
That's Marcos Ferreira from the health department, and he says that every year sexually transmitted diseases during Carnival are a concern. So in all the official Carnival venues, they distribute condoms, and this year especially.
So what has Zika done to dampen excitement over Carnival? Have you heard of any tourists canceling their trips yet?
I've heard of people who are going to come to Rio, even reporters who are going to come cover the Olympics who have canceled their travels, some tourists canceling their travels. Locally, it's a concern because if you live here, you know, your environment determines what risk you're going to have. Standing water and trash and buzzing mosquitoes aren't equally distributed across the city. So folks in low-income neighborhoods are certainly concerned about lack of sanitation there. Two-thirds of the homes in Rio don't have their sewage collected and treated. And that's something that folks here have fought for a long time to get. And with this concern is even more important.
So Rio's also got another even bigger event coming up, the Summer Olympics, which are less than 6 months away. Lots of investment there. Is that of even bigger concern for officials in Brazil?
It's certainly a concern. And so the treatment that they're doing now at the Samba Stadium, which is weekly pesticide spraying, is going to begin in Olympic venues starting in April. And that's where athletes are staying. That's where the competitions will be. As those venues, some of them are still under construction, so they're being inspected as they're being finished. The hope is that additional mosquito infection there will be prevented by this.
And I gather the Brazilian military is going to be involved trying to beat back the Zika virus before the Olympics. What can the military do?
That's mostly in the north of Brazil, where public health is even more precarious. Mm-hmm. And essentially, troops are going in, fumigating larger areas. And this is areas where there isn't a sort of neighborhood by neighborhood health posts like there are in the city of Rio. In the city of Rio, there's a health official for every 800 to 1,000 homes who's responsible for inspecting the homes, even inside homes. Is there a swimming pool with standing water, etc.? In other parts of the country, the infrastructure isn't as developed as that. So you have these sort of widespread spraying fumigation campaigns.
So, Catherine, you live in Rio. How front and center is Zika in terms of media, the public health campaign, and is it reflected in people's urgency and their concern?
It's certainly becoming more urgent, as I think Brazilians are also aware of how much global media and global populations are aware of it. It took a long time for the government to sort of have a TV address say, this is an emergency, declare a public health emergency. It was declared in December. You know, there's a widespread sentiment of, we wish that we were informed about this sooner. We wish that there was better sort of sanitation coverage in our city. Certainly resentment on the part of mothers and deep sadness on the part of, for example, mothers who've had children born with microcephaly. So it's a growing concern, certainly.
Reporter Catherine Osborne, based in Rio. Thanks very much, Catherine.
Thank you, Marco.
Italy still doesn't recognize civil unions for same-sex couples, but is that about to change? That story is coming up ahead on The World. I'm Marco Werman with The World. Oil prices hit 12-year lows this month. Now, that might sound like it would be bad for the environment. We drive more if gas is cheap. It also makes renewables seem more expensive in comparison, and you'd think that would push companies away from building new solar panel arrays or wind farms. But actually, investments in renewables hit record highs in 2015, up to nearly $330 billion worldwide. That's according to a recent report by Bloomberg New Energy Finance, where Angus McCrone is a senior analyst. Why haven't these $30 a barrel oil price has been hurting renewable energy, Angus?
Well, there's a lot of reasons. I mean, the first is that oil doesn't actually compete directly with renewable energy in most cases. Oil is not used as a power generation technology, except in a small percentage of plants worldwide. Normally, it's gas and coal that are up against renewables. And although gas and coal prices have fallen also, it hasn't been as big a decline as happened with oil. Second thing is that all this time, renewable energy costs have been tumbling. So there's huge gains going on there.
So does this represent a watershed that people are not recoiling from renewable investment just because gas prices are low?
I think it certainly marks a change from around the 2007 period where people equated interest in renewables with high oil prices. And now people are beginning to appreciate that actually the renewables revolution will go on even if oil, coal and gas keep on getting cheaper.
And I gather investment in renewables was the highest in China and the U.S. in 2015, but apparently markets are growing in lots of smaller places as well. Where are you looking for solar and wind to take off in the next few years?
Well, as you say, one of the really exciting developments we've seen over the last few years has been the spread of wind and solar to more and more emerging markets in the world. So, for instance, in 2015, the countries that were in the sort of $1 billion investment club included South Africa, Mexico, Chile, Turkey, Thailand, Morocco, and Uruguay. And in 2016, we could see others break into that.
I'm curious, how much did the finalized climate change agreement in Paris in December kind of amp up interest in renewables, or is it too soon to say?
Well, in terms of the actual impact on investment, obviously 2015 was more or less over by the time the Paris Climate Change Conference actually happened, and 2016 will still be too early to see Paris having a tangible effect, I think. But in the meantime, there's a lot of other issues which are speeding the energy transition, as we call it, around the world. One is energy security. Another driver is pollution. Mm. Some of the big third world cities like Beijing and Delhi are really severe. Those countries are seeing renewables a way of actually cleaning things up. And a couple of other things I was going to mention. One is speed. If you're a developing country and you want to install some generating capacity, then you can build a wind farm or a solar plant much more quickly than you can a coal-fired power station. And the other one is finance. There's quite a bit of development bank finance available for renewables, whereas a lot of development banks and also commercial banks are kind of reluctant now to invest in coal-fired power stations. It looks bad in terms of their own environmental obligations, and there are risks. If regulations change, will they actually get their money back?
Sounds like you see the future for renewables in a pretty optimistic light.
Yes, I mean, there are always issues to deal with when it comes to the growth of renewables, but there's a strong momentum here. Climate change is part of that, but economics is a really strong part of that as well, as the costs of generation for renewables have come down so much over the last 5 years, and they're still developing technologies, so those costs will come down even more over the next 10 years.
Angus McCrone, chief editor for Bloomberg New Energy Finance, he's been speaking with me from London. Thank you, Angus, for your time.
Thank you.
You may not know this, but Italy is the only major country in Western Europe not to recognize same-sex civil partnerships. That's been the focus of several protests recently in Italian cities. And many of the demonstrators took to the streets carrying alarm clocks.
Going on the street with an alarm clock means wake up Italy, it's time to join the rest of Europe on gay unions.
That's Gianni Riotta, a columnist with the Italian daily La Stampa. He often joins us on The World to talk about what's happening in Italy. And this week, what's happening is a debate in the country's parliament over legislation that would grant gay couples the right to form civil unions. Italy's prime minister is in favor of the proposal, but there's pushback from conservative Italians. Still, Gianni Riotta says gay couples in Italy are optimistic that discrimination against gays might be coming to an end.
It has been awful because, you know, in Italy, when the husband dies, his pension goes to the widow. But a lot of homosexual couples, when they lose their partner, they lose the income or any kind of property, houses or land. So it has been a lot of grievances, a lot of discomfort. And if I have to say what I think, the Italian society has been ready at least for 20 years, but the politicians were so afraid.
I remember a couple of years ago, Barilla, the Italian pasta company, caused a kind of a big, even international uproar when the head of the company went on talk radio in Italy and said, Barilla embraces family values, that's why there are no same-sex couples in Barilla advertisements. So today, what is the mindset of Italian lawmakers who oppose this bill?
You know, it's interesting what happened in Barilla after that. There was a huge boycott in the United States. The owner of Barilla apologized, and now their advertisement is so much nicer and much more inclusive than it used to.
So they changed their tune.
Yeah, they changed their tune. But conservatives are against, and Christian conservative Catholics are against. You know, but they are not a majority in the Italian society now for many decades, I'd say. And also, you see, Papa Bergoglio, the new pontiff, Pope Francis, is not pursuing a cultural agenda at all. So even the Catholic establishment has been very cautious.
So Italy's kind of confusing. Is Italian society very Catholic or is it very secular?
Italy is confused. My dad, that was a very devout Catholic, would say, when I was a kid, the church were filled up with people that were not believer at all. Now the church are very empty. There are very few people in church, but those that go are very, very profoundly devout. So the society has changed.
So Iranian President Rouhani is in Rome, and they had to cover up statues, nude statues, yesterday on his visit to the museums. Did he witness any of these demonstrations on his trip to Rome? Because Ahmadinejad famously said there were no homosexuals in Iran.
The interesting thing is that now there is a huge story in Italy going on. Who ordered the statue to be covered? Because the Italian Minister of Culture said I wasn't. The Italian Prime Minister said I wasn't. Nobody actually issued an order, apparently. And so it could have been like some zealous executive or a director, I don't know. It was ridiculous. It was ridiculous. And but as usual, you know, as usual, it was something funny, dash, ridiculous. But of course, the Italians are making such a fuss about it, losing sight of what was a very important visit by Rouhani.
Did he sign a contract with Barilla?
I don't know. I don't know. We'll ask. I hope for the Iranian people, because pasta is always very good.
Gianni Riotta, a columnist for the Italian daily La Stampa, speaking with me from Rome, where parliamentarians will be debating tomorrow whether to join the rest of Europe in recognizing same-sex unions. Gianni, thank you very much.
Thank you very much, guys.
You're tuned to The World. I'm Marco Werman. So what is it like to get up close and personal with a golden eagle?
He just looked into my eye and it just went through me. I'm not kidding you. I felt like my entire body was an electric charge piercing through my soul.
The intense eyes of an eagle, plus some American sailors run into trouble again on the high seas. That's coming up on The World.
The World is brought to you by Public Radio International with support from TIAA CREF, a global financial company that's created to serve and built to perform. You can learn more at TIAA.org.
I'm Marco Werman, and you're tuned to The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. The migrant crisis in Europe has shown that not all countries respond the same way to new arrivals. Some offer a warm welcome. Other countries try to keep out asylum seekers or move them to someplace else. Those are the two extremes. So what about us here in the U.S.? What's it like for refugees who resettle here? Well, again, it depends a lot on where you go. So let's take one case, the city of St. Cloud, Minnesota. A large number of Somali refugees now call it home. St. Cloud is about an hour's drive northwest of Minneapolis. It's not the most welcoming place for Somalis. That's the word from Susan Du. She's a reporter for City Pages newspaper. Your story, Susan, in City Pages profiles several Somalis who make St. Cloud their home. How'd they get there in the first place?
Well, there was a civil war in Somalia in the 90s, and once that broke out, many Somalis had to flee, and the U.S., in particular Minnesota, became a landing spot. So St. Cloud stands out, I think, because St. Cloud, this small city in the middle of the state, has had some very real tensions with accepting them, allowing them to assimilate, welcoming them, simply being willing to open their arms and open their communities to these refugees.
Yeah, specifically, what have Somalis had to deal with in terms of discrimination in St. Cloud? What kind of stories did you hear?
Well, there's a lot of everyday discrimination. Folks driving down the street, having people roll down their windows and yell at them to go back to their homes. Altercations in grocery stores, where if a Somali family, even if they know how to speak English, are speaking Somali to each other, are told by strangers, learn English or go back to your country. There's a lot of bullying among the children, kids taking what they hear from home to the classrooms, telling their Somali classmates, we know that you're just here to take welfare, you get all sorts of free stuff, you're living basically on the backs of our parents. And they're being called ISIS, they're being called the N-word. You know, back after 9/11, they were asked, you know, do you know the whereabouts of Osama bin Laden? And so on and so forth.
Right. So how have Somalis in St. Cloud responded to the insults and the objects thrown at them and the calls to go back to Somalia?
I think they've responded with tremendous dignity. They're here, like many generations of immigrants from different countries before them, to build a life. And the thing about St. Cloud is that it's not a wealthy place. It's not a particularly exciting place. Nobody goes there, really, other than to simply live, to strike out a living. And they're there because they do appreciate the opportunity to live a safe life and to build their families. And there are those in the community that tell them, you ought to be more grateful. You shouldn't complain at all because, you know, things are going to be so much worse in Somalia. But of course they understand that. And I think they just roll with the insults. Sometimes they do talk back and try and confront the stereotypes and the false information. But I think a lot of them have also just learned to ignore and accept that as a part of their daily existence.
I mean, the fact that St. Cloud is a city with a lot of poverty, is that part of the problem? Poor longtime residents versus poor new arrivals? Everybody's kind of striving?
Exactly. I think that's one factor contributing to the cultural tension. St. Cloud is not a wealthy place. There are jobs, but they're not well-paying jobs. There are a lot of old industries out there, meatpacking, paper mills. But the city overall is 25% of the people live below the poverty line. And there's a sense that if there's not that much to go around already, that sort of fuels these conspiracy theories about these refugees somehow receiving so much more from the government that they're living well, better than the local residents.
Where did you find signs that St. Cloud can figure a way out of these tensions and hatred? I mean, how seriously is the city taking this?
I think the city at this point has recognized that it has a reputation for cultural intolerance, that even if a majority of the people that live in St. Cloud are well-meaning, kind, and welcoming people, that there aren't at the same time enough people willing to step up and say that we can't tolerate that intolerance.
Susan Du, reporter with the City Pages newspaper in Minneapolis, thanks for telling us about what's going on in St. Cloud.
Thanks, Marco.
Another story now about refugees who've been in the U.S. since the 70s, Iranians. The nuclear deal with Iran brought about something the authorities in Tehran were desperate for, relief from Western economic sanctions, some of them at least. Now, for example, Iran is allowed to sell its oil on international markets. The partial lifting of sanctions could also mean that more Iranian goods, like Persian rugs, are imported into the U.S. Saul Gonzalez of station KCRW met an Iranian-American merchant in Los Angeles who's hoping to boost his business.
There's a stretch of Westwood Boulevard in Los Angeles called Little Persia. It's the commercial heart of L.A.'s large Iranian-American community, full of Persian restaurants, bakeries, and Farsi-language bookstores. It's also where you'll find a store called Damoka Rugs, a business that hopes to benefit almost immediately from the lifting of trade sanctions against Iran.
Have you already started calling people in Iran and rug makers that you know of or know personally and say, hey, time to sell, time to ship?
Yes, exactly. I called already to the city of Tabriz, which I come from, and I told my weavers to pack them, start shipping them.
That's Alex Helmy, the owner of Damoka, which specializes in selling fine Persian rugs. As piano music tinkles over the store's sound system, Helmy talks to me in his spacious two-story showroom that's filled with exquisitely designed, handcrafted rugs, many antiques.
See, this is like 200 years old. It's a tribal cup. This is 100 years old. That's a Tabriz, 100 years old. Guys, can we go upstairs? Look at this carpet.
Because of the trade sanctions against Iran, Helmi has been banned from importing rugs like these into the U.S. But now that some sanctions have been lifted, including those covering rugs, Helmi couldn't be happier. He says rugs and politics shouldn't mix.
You know, I mean, you cannot sanction an art, you know, because this is an art that has been there for hundreds and hundreds of years. And the rugs that were made 150 years ago doesn't have anything to do with politics, you know, or even the people that they weave these rugs. They don't know what is going on.
The hand weaving of rugs with elaborate colors and intricate designs has been a part of Iranian culture for centuries, and each rug requires an enormous commitment of time and skill by artisans.
Some of these rugs takes 10 years, five people to make. I mean, it is incredible dedication. A family has to work for years and years until the carpet is finished. Then they can sell it.
In his store, Helmi shows me one of his favorite rugs hanging on the wall, featuring calligraphy and a riot of colors that come from natural dyes derived from pomegranate skins and walnuts.
Look how this turquoise, cinnamon, this ruby red color, the bronze, blue, gold. You see how next to each other is beautiful, huh?
But such beauty costs. The rugs in Helmi's inventory range in price from $1,000 to $250,000. Helmi says, though, that no matter what the price, American collectors are eager to buy rugs that will be imported from Iran, both new and antique.
You know, it's like wine. Age matures the color.
It adds to the character of it.
Yes, it just matures the color. So that's what the older carpet are very valuable.
Helmi's been selling fine Persian rugs since he first came to the U.S. in the 1970s. He learned the trade from his father, who started exporting rugs from Iran to Europe after World War II. He also keeps to his father's courtly old-world approach to business, like serving refreshments on a silver tray to people who visit his store.
What is this?
This is Persian tea.
Oh, lovely. Thank you so much.
Helmi also makes house calls, making sure his customers are buying just the right rug for their home or office.
First, 90% of my clients, I go visit their home first. I look at the ambience of the room. I look at how furniture should be placed in the room. Is the house Mediterranean, Spanish, Italian, French, American, Art Deco? And based on that and the color combination, it's like psychology. I spend hours with them.
Helmi says his first shipment of rugs from Iran should arrive this week, and he hopes every rug he sells contributes in a small way to weaving better ties between Iran and the United States. For The World, I'm Saul Gonzalez, Los Angeles.
The Sundance Film Festival is happening now in Utah, and one documentary in particular caught our eye. It's called The Eagle Huntress. It's about a young girl in Mongolia who, as the title suggests, hunts with a golden eagle. So when the young subject of the film and its director headed to Park City, they had hoped to bring one more star from the film, the eagle. But that did not work out with customs, so the Comanche Nation stepped in to provide a loner golden eagle. That's a story we want to ask Vincent Schilling about. He's arts and entertainment editor at the news site Indian Country Today. The filmmakers couldn't bring their golden eagle that stars in the film, so the Comanche Nation stepped in. They have a sanctuary, I'm guessing. Where is it?
Yeah, it's in Oklahoma, and they've been raising golden eagles and other birds for decades.
Wow. So I hear the star of the documentary has been doing all sorts of photo ops in Park City with her eagle on loan. Is this a point of pride for the Comanche that one of their birds is kind of getting this moment of celebrity?
I'll tell you, people from everywhere. It's brilliant as far as a director's concerned to bring an eagle because people are going to notice. You know, they always say don't share the camera with an animal or a child, no one's going to look at you. So, you know, but they've got it too. They got a child and an eagle. Boy, that's a win-win to me.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's really kind of charming, this relationship between mm-hmm. the eagle and the girl and the eagle huntress. Yeah. What do you know about this relationship in this part of the world between people and these eagles?
Well, it's interesting. I was talking to a lot of folks at the Comanche Nation, and their program is called the SIA program, S-I-A, which is Comanche for feather. And, they also say, we prefer Numana, which is the traditional name for the Comanche people.
Numana.
But they've been working with the Mongolian people and the Kazakhs for many, many generations. And the eagles are connective tissue to the Mongolians as well as they're connective to us in terms of a spiritual. So the Comanche Nation gave her a name, they honored her, and they feel as though, if someone's going to do it, she's doing it right. She's doing out of respect, love, and wanting to connect with the eagle in the similar way that Native people overall honor the eagle as a great spiritual force in this world.
So the Numana, the Comanche, do they have a tradition of hunting with eagles like they do in Mongolia?
Not that I've seen.
Okay.
Not that I've ever seen. Eagles are revered because they fly the highest, because they are essentially the closest to the Creator, that we believe them to carry prayers to the Creator. Calling upon the eagle to deliver prayers is something that is very similar in many tribal cultures. We also revere the feather, which is why it's so painful to see people, what you might say as hipsters, that folks wearing these headdresses as a fashion, accessory,
right?
Because it's not a fashion accessory. So the connection to the Mongolian people is the incredible reverence toward eagles.
Yeah.
And reverence towards the majesty of golden eagles whose wingspan is up to 7.5 feet wide.
So it is really that spiritual side that is the link between the Comanche and the Kazakh people of Mongolia. I mean, it
Absolutely.
May be hard for people who've never been up close to an eagle, who've only seen them way up in the sky, to get a sense of that.
Exactly.
But you did. I mean, I was checking out a picture of you
yes,
releasing an eagle rehabilitated by an animal sanctuary in Virginia. So
mm-hmm. it was
what
amazing.
Was that like?
Yeah. Oh, my gosh. And it was a surprise because I'm a journalist. I was covering the story and they said, well, Vincent, come on up. We want you to release it. And I was like, whoa, what? First of all, I didn't expect it to be so heavy. To be that heavy and to be able to lift himself up. And he turns around as I have these long gloves on, and then he bites my tie. And I was like, wow, it was pretty wild.
And it was one of those with one of those 6-7 foot wingspans, it looked like.
Yes. And then as I'm holding him, I was like, all right, selfishly, I'm going to hold him for – I just got to – come on. How in my life is this ever going to happen again? So I wanted to just look at him. And then he turned his head all the way around, and his eyes were like this golden – I can't even explain – and he just looked into my eye, and it just went through me. I'm not kidding you. I felt like my entire body was an electric charge piercing through my soul. And I was just like, wow. And I was shaken to the core, and then I released him, and he kind of lifted me up. I felt his first flap, and it was just like incredible. The feeling of it was just kind of overwhelming, to be honest with you. And
yeah, you're standing on the back of this pickup truck, it looks like.
Yes.
And your feet are actually 4 inches off the ground.
Yes. I felt the flap. I was like, one more flap and I'm going with him. I was like, and part of me was like, take me with you. I don't mind. it's just unbelievable moment. I really will never forget it ever. I'll be 100 years old going, remember that time the eagle? I could just feel it. It was just unbelievable. Really, really, truly unbelievable.
Vincent Schilling, arts and entertainment editor for Indian Country Today, making the Native American Mongolian eagle link for us. Vincent, great to
yes.
speak with you. Thank you for the stories.
Thanks so much.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. If you've ever visited the White House in Washington, you've probably seen it just across the street in Lafayette Square, a tent plastered with brightly colored hand-painted signs protesting nuclear proliferation. One sign reads, "Live by the bomb, die by the bomb." It's kind of hard to miss it. And after 3 decades at the square, it's considered the longest-running political protest in U.S. history. For much of that time, a woman named Concepcion Picciotto was one of the tent's most recognizable occupants. On Monday, Concepcion died. It's thought that she was in her 80s, and the fact that we don't know is a hint of the kind of dramatic backstory she had. Timothy Wilkerson directed The Oracles of Pennsylvania Avenue. It's a documentary that tells the story of the core protesters at Lafayette Square, including Connie, as she was known.
Connie was a Spanish immigrant to this country. She was a orphan from a very early age, and she moved to this country in about early 1960s. And she worked for a time for the Spanish embassy and also for the United Nations and also for the 1964 World's Fair, the Spanish Pavilion there. Then she got married, and her husband was kind of a rat, Fink, and he stole her money and left her high and dry, and she ended up basically on the streets in D.C., and she started hanging out with Bill Thomas and Norman Mayer, who were protesters in Lafayette Park there.
Take us to the scene. I mean, here's this woman, probably somewhere in her 70s or 80s, as I said, and she's been protesting for more than 30 years. Had she been out there up until the day she died this week?
Pretty much. I mean, there were some notable exceptions. The Department of Interior had promulgated several restrictions on them, several regulations that were bent really on extricating them from the park. But other than a few days in which the park district had shut down the park entirely, she was out there every day of the year.
Yeah, through blizzards and heat waves in Washington. I mean, that takes endurance.
Yeah, it really does. I mean, there's a certain mental endurance and physical endurance, and I'm sure that contributed to her demise.
What did she look like? Describe her.
Connie was a short lady, kind of stocky, and she had kind of a hat that she wore that was almost like a helmet. It was like a giant wig, and she wore a scarf over the top of that. So it made her head look disproportionately large for her body, really. And I think a lot of people were taken aback by that and were, you know, some people didn't want to approach her. But once they did approach her, they found her to be a very amiable person. And she had a lot of things to say about nuclear disarmament and also about, you know, other things like uranium-tipped weapons and things like this, which they were also protesting against.
Let's hear a little excerpt of Connie from your movie, The Oracles of Pennsylvania Avenue. Here she's summarizing her rationale for why she's been in front of the White House for all these years.
I call this, what you call the White House, I call the head of the octopus and the tentacles all over the world.
So the White House is the head of the octopus, the tentacles all over the world. How did she see what she was doing? What was she accomplishing in her view?
Well, you know, the name of my film is Oracles of Pennsylvania Avenue, and I feel like they felt as if they were the vanguard or the oracles warning people about what could happen in the future, not just Connie, but all the rest of them as well.
I mean, she was not immune to conspiracy theories. She blamed the government for many things, including some of her physical ailments. After spending a lot of time with her, what was your impression of her mental health?
Yeah, I mean, there was that. And I think that stemmed as far back as her losing her daughter to her husband. Her husband basically kidnapped her daughter and took off with all of her savings. And there was very little help from attorneys and very little help from the government, she felt, in getting her daughter back. And I think that whole conspiratorial feeling kind of stemmed from some of the things that happened to her personally. I think you have to be a little bit off to be doing that type of work, and it was work. Let's get that clear. I mean, they stood out there and spoke to millions of people every year in all sorts of types of weather. I don't necessarily know her well enough to comment about her mental state, but she seemed very just kind of dogmatic about her stances.
What will happen to the protest encampment now that Picciotto is gone? Did she pass on the torch to someone else?
That is a very good question. I'm in communication now with Ellen Thomas, who is William Thomas's husband and who became a vigiler there as well and was out on the street for like 18 years. And she hasn't really told me what's going to happen to the vigil. I hope that it continues.
Timothy Wilkerson is the director of the Oracles of Pennsylvania Avenue. I know you spent a lot of time with Concepcion Picciotto, so our condolences to you, Timothy. Thanks for your time.
Thank you so much for your time.
Finally today, a cautionary tale from the high seas. Back in July, Steve Shapiro made a fateful decision.
Well, I bought a boat in Norway, and in order to get it home, I could either put it in a box and send it, or I could sail it myself. And it's my boat. I've been sailing since I was 9.
So Shapiro, who's 71 now, decided to sail it back to Maine. He called up Bob Weiss, also 71, and asked if he wanted to be his crewmate. Weiss said yes. They christened the boat Nora and set off from Norway. The trouble began almost immediately.
The first call was to the Norwegian Rescue Service. The engine was disconnected and we lost power. They said, well, you're a sailboat, sail. The current was pulling us at 6 knots in the other direction. So we didn't have an engine to pull us out of it. And they thought for about 4 seconds, said, OK, we'll be there in 2 hours.
That would be the first of 9 times the men have been rescued in the past 7 months.
We were on the radio with various Coast Guards about 23 times, they say.
Other unplanned stops included Denmark, Scotland, Northern Ireland, and the Republic of Ireland, and now St. Ives. That's in Cornwall on England's southwest coast.
Another little mishap. We've made the news.
The British press have dubbed the men calamity captains. Maybe that's why Steve Shapiro agreed to an interview with our colleagues at BBC Radio 4.
This is a boat that's new to me, and it's a 38-year-old boat. And there's nothing that happened that could have been foreseen. We are fully aware of the circumstances and fully capable seamen, and want to take this opportunity to assure people that that we're in control of our boat.
But not everyone agrees. Robin Knox Johnston is a well-known British sailor, and he said this about Steve and Bob. This is no longer a joke. They need to pack it in or get the hell out of our waters. A local harbor master also said they're a catastrophe waiting to happen. It was a charity that rescued the pair off Cornwall, and they say each person they rescue costs them around $24,000. They don't ask for repayment. Shapiro admits it's been a long 6 months.
I expected to buy this boat in July and be in Maine in August. And it's far from August.
Well, maybe they just have bad luck. And yet Shapiro and Weiss are determined to get themselves and Nora back home. The BBC asked Steve when he planned on quitting.
When I'm home.
The little sailboat that could. Yeah, well, that remains to be seen. And that's the world on this Wednesday. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH, I'm Marco Werman. We're back with you all tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.